We are finishing up our Messing Up series this morning, and we're looking at God's presence with us in the midst of our messes of life. And the messes in our lives, we've talked about this over the last first 2 weeks of the series. And if you're kind of new to the series, you haven't had if you maybe might have missed one, you can go back and on our website, and it's got them there, and it'll kind of catch you up to speed. But the kind of the essence of the series was that the messes that we experience are actually gracious doorways that God uses to help us experience his existence, right? We talked about that in the first week, but more importantly, to experience his presence. And we talked about this, and it is our messiness as humanity that actually brought God near, right? One of the most famous verses in all of the Bible is John chapter 3, verse 16, that God loved the world. God loved the messy world, the messy people in the world, so much that he gave his son so that no one would spend eternity separate. No one would die, but would all have everlasting life. And that God didn't come into the world. Many people have this idea that God is just a judge sitting there waiting to just slam the hammer, but God did not send his son into the world. The most famous verse is John 3:16, but the most important one is John 3:17, that God did not send Jesus into the world to condemn the world, but to rescue or redeem or deliver the world through him. In other words, to experience his presence in the midst of whatever messes we may be in, that our messes do not repulse God. In fact, it was our messes that brought God near, and to redeem us and to help us write a better story. So here's kind of where we're going this morning. Have you ever made a mess? Let's all just be honest. First week we said we're all messes, right? I think some people were like, how dare you? I mean, the truth is we're all messes. How many of you have ever made a mess that you've tried to clean up and you've only made it worse? Put your hand up. Yeah, I talked a couple of weeks about when I was working as a college pro painter. We spilled paint on someone's driveway and made it worse by trying to clean up an oil-based paint with water. Which just made the mess bigger and worse. I'm sure that if I were to ask all those hands that were raised, we would all say, yeah, here's my story, right? We all have an example. But sometimes you're in the midst of a messy situation, and every decision that you try to make to get out of it just sort of snowballs the mess, or the problem gets worse or gets bigger, right? I think we can all identify with that. I came across this story. Some of you may have heard it before, and it's about a bricklayer that had a mess get away from him. Here's how it goes. Dear sir, I am writing in response to your request for additional information in block 3 of the accident report. I originally put poor planning as the cause for the accident. However, you asked for a further explanation, and I trust the following details will be sufficient. I'm a bricklayer by trade, and on the day of the accident, I was working alone on the roof of a new 6-story building. When I completed my work, I found I had some bricks left over, which when weighed were found to weigh 400 pounds. Rather than carry the bricks down by hand, I decided to lower them in a barrel by using a pulley which was attached to the side of the building at the 6th floor. Securing the rope at ground level, I went up to the roof, swung the barrel out, and loaded the bricks into it. Then I went down and untied the rope, holding it tightly to ensure a slow descent of the 400 pounds of bricks. You will note on the accident report that my weight is 135 pounds. Due to my surprise at being jerked off the ground so suddenly, I lost my presence of mind and forgot to let go of the rope. Needless to say, I proceeded at a rapid rate up the side of the building. In the vicinity of the 3rd floor, I met the barrel, which was now proceeding downward at an equally impressive speed. This explains the fractured skull and broken collarbone as listed in section 3 of the accident report. Slowed only slightly, I continued my rapid ascent, not stopping until the fingers of my right hand were 2 knuckles deep into the pulley. Fortunately, I was able to hold the rope in spite of the excruciating pain I was now beginning to experience. At approximately the same time, however, the barrel of bricks hit the ground, and the bottom fell out of the barrel. Now empty of the weight of the bricks, the barrel weighed approximately 50 pounds. I refer you again to my weight, and as you might imagine, I began a rapid descent down the side of the building. In the vicinity of the third floor, I met the barrel coming up. This accounts for the two fractured ankles, broken tooth, and severe lacerations of my legs. Here, though, my luck began to change slightly. The encounter with the barrel seemed to slow me down enough to lessen my injuries when I fell onto the pile of bricks at the bottom. I am sorry to report, however, as I lay there on the pile of bricks in pain, unable to move and watching the empty barrel six stories above me, I lost my presence of mind and let go of the rope. Now, that sounds, I think, like a funny story, unless you're the bricklayer, right? Just a cascading series of events that made the situation worse, right? And we can laugh about that because it happens to someone else. But when we're in a mess, we're in a situation that's messy, and it gets worse, it's not funny, right? When you're in a relational mess, or you make a relational mess worse, or you make a financial mess worse, or you make a professional mess worse, or an academic mess worse, or a morality mess worse, it's not funny. It's heartbreaking and it's overwhelming. And here's the reason I think we make messes worse. And this is true for everybody, right? We make messes worse because every single mess that you're involved in, whether it's your fault or whether somebody else makes a decision that involves you in their mess, every single mess comes with some really bad options to try and fix or clean up the mess, all right? When you think about the messes that we've been, maybe it's, you know, just send the text to try and hide to make it look like the first text wasn't actually supposed to go for that person, right? So you make up a story, you lie, you hide, you get rid of the evidence, or you just borrow a little bit more to try and clean up maybe it's a financial mess. And these bad options, straight up, if we're honest, they always make the mess worse. And so for the next couple of moments, what I want to talk about as we close up our series is how to keep from making a mess worse. And specifically, when it comes to a mess that you did not create, right? It's not your fault. Somebody else has involved you in either their mess or they've caused something to happen to make your life messy. And you are in the middle of a mess and you are tempted with options to clean it up that are only going to make your mess worse. And this morning, to kind of help talk about it, we're going to look at a story from the Old Covenant part of the Bible, so the Old Testament, and it's found in 1 Samuel chapter 24. And the story takes place about 1,000 years before Jesus is born. It's about 1,000 BC. And it's the story of a guy named David. Maybe some of you are familiar. And it's before he becomes known as King David. And this is a story about a mess that he got into, but one that was not his fault. And the story actually begins when David was a little boy. He's probably around 12 years old, I guess, we read. And one day the prophet Samuel shows up at his home and tells his father that he's going to anoint one of Jesse's eight sons. And he's going to anoint one of Jesse's eight sons as king of Israel. And it turns out it's going to be David. And so at the time, David is somewhere between 12 and 15 years old. It's like a teenager. When he's anointed king of Israel. The problem was that Israel already had a king at that time. His name is Saul. And so now they had two kings, right? Grown-up King Saul, and you had the young shepherd boy David. And at the time, David goes back to taking care of his family's sheep. But as time goes by, David begins to make a name for himself in the community, right? He protects his family's sheep from, you know, bears and lions and becomes famous for that. One day, his father actually sends him out to visit his brothers who are in Israel's army at the time, and they're fighting the Philistines. And David sees this huge giant named Goliath taunting Israel's army. And David figures out that, you know, David's not much bigger or much scarier than, you know, the lions and the bears that he's fought off from, you know, attacking his family's sheep. So David kills Goliath, and as you can imagine, he becomes like a rock star, like an overnight sensation. And everybody, because everybody knows what happened, because the entire army saw what David did. And so word about David spreads. Everybody's talking about him. The problem is, not many people were talking about King Saul anymore. And all Israel loved David. They loved what he had done, and he was leading them further, and he, you know, gets involved in the army, and he leads them in their military campaigns. And they begin to perceive him as the leader. Maybe this is the next king, right? In fact, Samuel, who wrote down this account, tells us that David continued to succeed in everything that he did, for the Lord was with him. And when Saul recognized this, he became even more afraid of him. But all Israel and Judah loved David because he was so successful at leading the troops into battle. And so King Saul recognizes that he's got a problem on his hands with David. And so he comes up with a plan to try and control things and keep it from getting worse. And so he decides he's going to marry one of his daughters to David. Because if he can make David his son-in-law, then he thinks he can kind of control, or at least manipulate his daughter and control David that way. So he goes to David and says, David, I would love for you to marry into my family. You become part of the royal family, and I will be your father-in-law. And David replies, says to Saul, who am I that I should receive this honor? You know, I'm just a lowly shepherd boy, and I'm from a family that's not very prestigious, not very important. I'm not worthy of the honor to marry one of your daughters. And, well, word gets out, and then it's like, David the humble. Can you believe how humble David was, that he gave up an opportunity to be part of the king's family? Well, David continues to get more and more popular, and Saul gets more and more jealous. And then one of Saul's other daughters, Michal, falls in love with David. And apparently David falls in love with her too. And Saul thinks, okay, I'm going to try this again. And so Saul goes to David and says, would you marry my daughter? And this time David says, yes, I will marry your daughter. And Saul says, aha, this is perfect. So he says to David, well, the bride price for my daughter isn't going to be an amount of money. It's not going to be flocks, what might have been the traditional. He said, the price for my daughter is going to be 100 dead Philistines. You have to bring evidence that you have killed 100 Philistines in order to marry my daughter. Because Saul's idea was there's no way he could touch David, because he's way too popular, but he would let the Philistines do that for him in battle, because there's no way that David and his buddies were ever going to be able to kill 100 Philistines. Well, David and his buddies went and killed 200 Philistines and brought back the evidence. And if you want to know what evidence they brought back, you're going to have to read 1 Samuel. I'm not going to bring it up here. And this makes things even worse for Saul. And Samuel tells us that when Saul realized that the Lord was with David and how much his daughter Michal loved him, right? Saul realizes that he's not going to be able to control David through his daughter. Says Saul became even more afraid of him, and he remained David's enemy for the rest of his life. Now, here's the connection for us this morning. David has a big and getting bigger mess on his hands. But it's not his fault, right? He didn't ask to be king. The whole Goliath thing, he was just doing what he was used to doing. He was serving, you know, his country, leading the army, same thing, just doing what people asked him to do. He refuses the king's daughter's hand initially, but no matter what he does, things just get worse and worse between him and Saul. And the situation escalates to the point that one afternoon, Saul loses it. He just loses it. And he picks up a spear and he tries to murder David in the palace. And David runs for his life, you know, heads out to the desert. And from that point on, Saul becomes incredibly focused. He ramps up his efforts to kill David because he's jealous. He wants his son Jonathan to be king. And as long as David is alive, he's a threat to the king. He's a threat to Saul's kingdom and the dynasty that Saul wants to leave for his family. But when David heads out, heads out to the desert, you know, to hide, to escape, he becomes an outlaw. And actually what happens is word is that David is out there and all of Saul's sort of political enemies start to gravitate to David. And it sort of seems wherever David goes, he gathers more and more people who support him, more and more, you know, people that come to be a part of his sort of squad. But Saul has not lost his desire to end David. And here's where the story gets really, really interesting. Saul is out fighting the Philistines, right? They're kind of like public enemy number one. They're like the arch enemy of Israel. And Saul is told that they have spotted, one of his, you know, spies has spotted David and his men hiding in the desert of En-Gedi. And they think that they've got him cornered at a place where they can, you know, that they can take care of it. And so Saul takes 3,000 of the best troops from the army, and they set out to hunt down David. And so the desert of En-Gedi is just this place where it's mountainous and there's caves everywhere and there's, you know, every once in a while you'll find an oasis or a spring. And David and his men are there near a spring, and Saul finds out and he thinks this is the chance to take care of David. And so the 3,000 men and everybody sort of accompanying the army heads out to get David. And Saul and his men are pursuing David. And Saul, King Saul, has to go to the bathroom. And when the king has got to go, it's a big deal. So nobody says to the king, could you not have gone before we left? And so, and probably, I want to say, you know, Samuel, very detailed. It's probably the only reference in the Bible about somebody going to the bathroom. And it says that Saul went into a cave to relieve himself, to go to the bathroom. So everybody stops, right? All 3,000, you know, people in the army, plus the support, and, you know, Saul gets down off his horse, and he follows a path, and he picks a cave, and he's, you know, in there getting ready to take care of business, and the army sits outside, and they wait. But David and his men are far back in that very same cave. Because word got out that Saul was coming, and so David says, instead of us trying to outrun them, let's split up, let's hide in this, you know, there's tons of caves, let's hide up until they're gone, then we'll regroup and go in the opposite direction. And so David and his men, a small group of his men, are hiding in the very cave that Saul chooses to go in and use the bathroom. And so here's the question. What are the odds of that happening? In this wilderness, this desert that is full of caves, what are the odds that Saul would choose the very cave that David and his men are in? I mean, if there was ever a God moment, this has got to be it. If ever God was performing a miracle on David's behalf, isn't this it? If Saul is the problem, and he is to David, then God has just provided the solution. What could be any clearer than this? And David's men that were hiding in the cave obviously thought the exact same thing because they said, this is it. This is the moment. God has delivered your enemy, our enemy, into your hands. They said, this is the day the Lord spoke of when he said to you, I will give your enemy into your hands to deal with as you wish. The men around David are saying, are you kidding me? It couldn't be any clearer. This is when we were sitting around the campfires and we were talking about how difficult a life this was and when would we ever get back to normal, and you told us that one day God would honor his commitment to you to be king. This is that day. And clearly God has delivered your enemy into your hands. Imagine what this is going to be like. All those people outside saw Saul go into the cave, and then suddenly they will watch you emerge from it. Think of it. And what could be better than that? And maybe one guy shouts out, yeah, and for full effect, it'd be so great if you walked out with Saul's severed head in your hand, right? There's always one guy in the group that wants to go big on that. And in that moment, they will all pledge their allegiance to you, and it will be an almost bloodless coup, and you will be king. David, in warfare, when you get a chance to end your enemy, you take it. This is it. Just imagine what it's going to be like, David. Well, as you can imagine, David gets caught up in the emotion, right, of the moment. I mean, and who wouldn't be? You've been an outlaw on the run, fearing for your life, having to hide. And now here is your enemy who's authored all of this mess by himself in probably what is the most vulnerable position possible. What could be more of a God thing? And so David decides to do to Saul what Saul had intended to do to David. And I mean, nobody could blame him, right? David would say to himself, I'm just going to do what Saul was trying to do to me anyway. Anyway, it's almost self-defense. So let's pause the story for just a second, and let's consider what David is about to do. And here's the connection to us in our messes. At the root of most of the messes that we make or that we find ourselves in, at the root of those messes is a loss or a breakdown in honor. Right? And honor is about acting with excellence or with virtue. In fact, Paul in the New Covenant, the New Testament, referenced the honorable or virtuous things that reflect God's spirit, right? They are integrity, honesty, humility, kindness, patience, self-control, goodness. We call them the fruits of the spirit. And when we look below the surface on the messes that we've made or that we've been involved in, somewhere in that mess, somewhere, we demonstrate or there's a demonstrable breakdown or lack of honor. And the truth is, when we ignore honor, we will eventually make a mess, right? When we ignore honor, we will eventually make a mess. It's just a matter of time. It's actually like an equation of cause and effect. If you ignore honor and act dishonorably in your relationships or in your profession or in education or in your finances, eventually you'll make a mess. And here is the hinge point that David was at. You don't clean up a failure of honor by adding another failure of honor, right? You don't clean up a flood with more water. You don't clean up a paint spill with more paint, right? My mom used to tell me, two wrongs do not make a right, and two messes don't cancel each other out. They don't make something clean. But here's the problem. Every mess comes with some bad options. And those bad options always involve a lowering or a breaking of the standard of honor. They always involve dishonor. And those are the options that we're tempted to reach out for quickly because they look like they promise to turn this mess around quickly, right? They're going to fix it. They're going to make it better, right? If we think about those situations, the messes that we've gotten ourselves into or been involved in by someone else, we're looking for the quick way out. How do we get this cleaned up quickly? And those quick fixes always involve some kind of dishonor, right? You know what? I can get out of this if I can just tell one more lie. That'll be it. I'll just borrow a little bit more money. I'll ask a friend to vouch for me so that nobody knows where I really went. And every mess has options that reflect a failure of honor, and you don't clean up a mess that way. But that is exactly what David was about to do. And Samuel tells us that David crept up unnoticed, and that would have been right in David's wheelhouse, right? He was a skilled fighter. He would creep up behind King Saul. Saul would never be aware of it, and the last thing that Saul would feel would be a yank on the back of his hair, and that would be the last breath that he would ever take. But as David is creeping up on Saul, I wonder if this dawned on him, because something dawns on him. Maybe it's dawned on you in a messy situation. I wonder if this dawns on David. I'm about to make this mess worse. I'm about to murder the king. I'm about to assassinate God's anointed leader, my father-in-law, my wife's father, and my kid's grandfather. What am I thinking? If I murder the king, this is going to be my story forever. And that is the tension we face. And this is where we get trapped. This is, I know, where I get trapped, right? Would David have been justified to take that kind of action? Everybody would have said, yes, absolutely. He was trying to kill you. You could say it was self-defense. Is it what everybody expected him to do, including his men in the cave with him? Absolutely. Was it the right thing, the honorable thing to do? Absolutely not. And he was about to add a part of his story that he would be embarrassed to tell for the rest of his life. What would he tell his kids when they said, "Dad, tell us again how you became king"? Well, your grandfather was taken up, whatever they called that, in 1000 BC, and he just walked into the cave, and he couldn't see very well, and I snuck up behind him, and I slit his throat, and that's how I became king. When his wife asked him, "David, what happened to my father?" "Well, honey, no one knows exactly. They just found him in the cave with his throat slit. We're not really sure what happened." See, David is about to make a decision that he would regret for the rest of his life. Even though it was justifiable, and even though it was what everybody expected, and even though you could argue it's what Saul deserved. And it's the same tension that we deal with in those hinge moments that we have, because every mess or messy situation comes with some really bad options. And so David creeps up unnoticed, but instead of killing Saul, he cuts off a corner of Saul's robe. And David's men farther back in the cave can't believe what they saw. They watched him get so close and then not do it. And then he comes back to the back of the cave with them. And then we read that afterward, David was conscience-stricken about having cut off a corner of the king's robe, because touching anything that belonged to the king was considered an offense. And he said to his men, "The Lord forbid that I should do such a thing to my master." I mean, what? "The Lord's anointed, or lay my hand on him, for he is the anointed of the Lord." He's saying, guys, God put Saul in place as king, and I can't replace him. It's not my responsibility. I don't have that authority. I don't want to become king by murdering the king. And you can imagine his men. Maybe it was the guy about the severed head. "Well, you know what? Like, we don't feel the same way as you do, right? You know, let's take care of it. I'll do it, right? We got no problem having his blood on our hands. We'll do what you're not willing to do." And it says, with these words, David sharply rebuked his men and did not allow them to attack Saul. And Saul left the cave and went his way. And then what happens next is, I think, just the coolest part. I can envision it being sort of at the key moment in like a blockbuster movie. So here's where we're at. Saul's men are waiting outside. They've been waiting in the heat for Saul to finish. And finally, Saul comes out, and nobody makes eye contact, and they all pretend like they have no idea why they stopped at the cave. And somebody helps Saul back up on his horse, and they're about to leave, and suddenly David appears at the mouth of the cave and calls out to Saul. Everybody turns, and and looks, and Saul, probably squinting in the sunlight, he says, is that who I think it is? And maybe his aide says, yes, your highness, it is your son-in-law, David. And everybody looking in that moment, everyone knew immediately what had just happened. Can you imagine that moment? And Samuel tells us what happened next as David sort of fills in the blanks for people. David yells out, this day you have seen with your own eyes how the Lord delivered you into my hands in the cave. Some urged me to kill you, but I spared you. I did what your own bodyguards didn't do. I protected you. I said, I will not lay my hand on my Lord because he is the Lord's anointed. You might not be acting like the Lord's anointed. You might be a bad example of the Lord's anointed king, but you are the Lord's anointed. And then he says something that I think we will encourage all of us to focus in on because it's so, so important. He says, may the Lord judge between you and me, and may the Lord avenge the wrongs you have done to me, because you have done me wrong, but my hand will not touch you. And what David communicated in that moment to Saul and to the soldiers was, I'm choosing honor over murder. I'm choosing honor over murder. I've done something that nobody could imagine. I've acted in such a way that is in a category all by itself. And you can imagine the moment. What can Saul do? He's absolutely humiliated. His bodyguards are humiliated. His soldiers are in awe of what has happened because they know the rules of warfare. When you get a chance to end your enemy, you do it. They've never seen anything like this. And David, we're told, Saul yells back to David, that you are a better man than me. I have treated you poorly, and you have treated me well. Then we read that Saul heads back to Jerusalem, and a few chapters later in the book of 1 Samuel tells us that in another battle, a random Philistine arrow pierces Saul's armor, and he dies, and David becomes the king of Israel. During our series, we've been asking, we asked a couple of our elders if they would share how it is in times that are very messy, sometimes very overwhelming, how it is that they tune their hearts to listen to God in those moments. And so we're going to ask this morning for Mark Relic, who usually mans the tech booth at the back with Gene, if he'll come and share with us a little bit.
Your mic's still live, by the way. good morning. It's good to be here with all of you. It almost seems like I'm interrupting Dean. And as he mentioned, usually my work is done back there, not up here. So when he asked me to share, I was a little bit surprised. I'm like, why is Dean asking me to share? Like, don't you agree? Like, he's so good at what he does, you know? And I'm not that good. So I was a little bit surprised, but then, I know he puts a lot of care and planning into a timely message for all of us. And, at my job, usually when we ask people to speak on things, we're bringing in subject matter experts and things like that. And I'm like, why is Dean asking me to come up and share? I'm like, this series is called Messing Up. Now I know. So anyways, bear with me this morning, but just a couple of points that I wanted to share with you this morning about a little bit about my journey. And I'm going to take you back to my university years. It was a formative time for me in university. I was going to U of T in STEM sciences, pursuing biology, and at the time. I did not know this, but when I got there, was really hit up with a challenge to my faith. Biology is a difficult field to get into if you're a Christian, because profs tend to hit you hard, about how your beliefs are kind of off center from science and things like that. Anyways, it was a good time, but a challenging time. And it stimulated in me a lot of deep questions about my faith, what I believe, who I am, what I believe about God. And so through that, I did come to understand that I knew that God had created our universe. And as a university science student, I could see that around me. And I had confidence in that. And the small piece that I could see and sort of begin to understand more and more about at university told me that we have this awesome God. And I'm like, if this God can create this huge universe and create all of these things, like, what is it that he cares for people? But I started to understand that people are so important to God. He created us in his image, and he desires us to be in a relationship with him and with each other and living that out. And being in my 20s, it was a very much a big realization for me. You know, I kind of grew up in a church where it's more about rules. You know, back to the revolutionary series, sacred people, sacred places. I lived through a lot of that. Do this, don't do that. You know, this is how you can be a good Christian. But at university, I started to understand it is a lot more about that and how we live out with people, live out that love of God, how we grow in our relationships with them. So that was a key point in my life. Ever since coming to that realization, I think I've been trying to learn about how to do that. It's easy to sort of come to the understanding, living that out each day, whether it's driving in a store with our neighbors here at work. There's so much, you know, everything can be connected to that. Our lives are kind of filled with times of challenge and times of joy. It never really seems super easy out there, but that perspective that we can gain from understanding why people are important to God, why relationships are important to God, and why they need to be important to us is critical, I think, for how we live out our lives, even in tough times. So I think I'll wrap it there and turn back to you, Dean.
Thanks, Mark. I think the key is what you said about how we're created not to be isolated or antagonistic towards others, but to honor others. And in the midst of a mess, particularly ones created by other people that are involve us and make our lives messy, it's hard to do that, right? Because the truth is every mess comes with some really bad options. And if you choose a bad option in the midst, you'll make your mess worse. And those options are so tempting to fix the mess. But here's the thing, and this is a reality in life, and if we can get this perspective, I know it will really, really help. Eventually, and this is the truth, maybe some of us who are a little bit older will maybe get this. Some of us who are younger, you can't figure it out yet. I know I had a tough time figuring that out when I was younger. But eventually the mess that you're experiencing now, or one that you will experience, that season of your life that is so dark and at the time so painful and horrifically complicated, it will eventually be reduced to one or two sentences when you talk about it. It will eventually be reduced to one or two sentences when you talk about it. I can say this. When I was 15, my parents got a divorce. All that pain and sadness, one sentence, right? All that pain and sadness at the time, all that darkness, that horrific complication in my life, reduced to one sentence as I think back on it. What would yours be? Maybe for some 2 years ago. 2 years ago, I was packaged out. One sentence. At the time, there's no way you thought you could reduce it to one sentence. 5 years ago, I had to declare bankruptcy. 6 months ago, I had to drop out of school. Last week, a friend betrayed me. All of these significant life events, these messy seasons of darkness and pain and discomfort, eventually they get reduced in the telling to a couple of sentences. Because it's your response to the mess that's the real story. It's our response to the mess that's the real story. The real story isn't the mess, right? We all are messes. We all make messes. We all encounter messes. Once you're in the middle of the mess, you can't unscramble eggs, right? The real story is our response to the mess. And our response to the mess becomes the permanent part of the story of our life, which brings me to a question I'm challenging myself, I'm challenging us to ask. And somehow, I think this question dawned on David. What story do I want to tell? What story do I want to tell? When David thinks, when people ask me, David, how did you become king of Israel? What story do I want to tell? How about you? When you're in the midst of that incredibly difficult time, incredibly difficult moment that seems to go on and on and on, it just keeps getting worse and worse. What story do you want to tell? When people hear that you went through a horrible mess, what story do you want to tell coming out of that? When people discover that you had to drop out of school or that you lost your job or that you had significant financial problems or a relationship ended, what story do you want to tell as a result of the options that you were presented with? Which option will you choose? Which option did you choose? Because your response to your mess is a part of the permanent story of your life. Which of those options do you want to be a part of the permanent story of your life? I can answer the question for you. You want the honorable option. You want the honorable option. It's rarely the easy option. It's rarely the quick fix option, but you want the honorable option. I faced up to them when I was confronted and I told the truth. I turned myself in. I asked exactly what I owed and I promised to pay them back. We cut up our credit cards and that was the end of that. I went to my teacher and I apologized and I have studied harder than at any other time in my life since then. I got counseling and I'm continuing to work on that part of my life. I forgave them. Which of the options do you want to be a permanent part of your story coming out of your mess? Because the real story is not the mess. It's how we respond to the options. And in my life, I'm being real honest, I have added a lot of paint to spills. I've added more water to a flood. And I want to encourage us, don't do the same thing and make the mess worse. So don't choose an option that makes you a liar. Right? After you got caught, what did you do? I made up story. Right? When you knew you were busted, what did you do? Made up story. Don't opt for anything that makes you a liar or a hypocrite. And I don't know that we'll ever grow out of this temptation as an option, but please, maybe it's more for the young people. Don't use somebody else's bad behavior as an excuse to behave badly. That was David's dilemma. He had every reason in the world to use Saul's bad behavior as an excuse for bad behavior. It was easily justifiable. So easy to say for us to say, if that's the way they're going to act, then I'm justified to act in the same way. I promise you it will just make the mess worse. And that is not the story that anybody wants to tell. And I do understand. I understand when we find ourselves in a mess, we want a quick fix, right? You know, one more time and I'm out. One more lie and I'm good. One more loan and I'm gold. One more, one more, one more. We all want the quick fix. And we also all want an eye for an eye, right? If you treat me poorly, game on, right? You poke me in the eye, I'm going to poke you in the eye until we're both blind. Instead, in those hinge moments, think about this. Think about the story that you have the opportunity to tell. David, how did you become king? Answer, I did what no one would do. I did what nobody expected me to do. I didn't do what I could justify. I didn't do what I could get away with. I opted for honor versus a quick fix. I trusted my Father in heaven to take care of this. That's one of the reasons why Jesus says, trust me. He fixes our biggest mess, which is our relationship and isolation that we have with God because of our rebellion. And then he says, follow me, and I will lead you through and out of your messes. And if you follow me, if you follow me, we're going to walk around a whole bunch of bad options that others may opt for, a whole bunch of options that will make those people around you question your sanity because they know what you should do, right? Here's what you should tell her, right? Here's what you tell them, or here's how you make sure that you don't get caught again, or here's how you make them pay for what they did. Jesus is saying, if you follow me, if you follow my way, we're going to avoid a whole bunch of those bad options that will only make your mess worse. And one day, when you talk about your mess and you sum it up, and when you talk about your response to the mess, you won't have to lie, and you won't be embarrassed, you won't be a hypocrite, and you will not have used someone else's bad behavior as an excuse to behave badly. So follow me. Follow me. Follow me, and I will leverage your mess into a good message for your life. That's what I do. I redeem, I rescue, I deliver messy things. I make beautiful things out of messy things. I bring triumph out of the context of tragedy. And so this morning, what story do you want to tell? Parents, what story do you want to tell your kids one day when they're grown? If you're in high school, what story do you want to talk about in those messy situations that erupt on a daily basis in high school? What do you want to be as a part of the permanent part of your story? If you will embrace that idea of following Jesus and honoring him by choosing the honorable thing in the midst of very difficult circumstances, that's following Jesus, and that is messing up. Let's pray. Father God, we thank you for your word. We thank you for this example of David. We thank you that, Lord, what we've understood in this series is that our messes don't repulse you. They scare us. They confuse us. They can feel so defeating and so, like we're so weighted down, we just don't know what way to go. But you promise, have promised, and we see the evidence of giving of your Son in the midst of our mess, in the midst of our rebellion, in the midst of us shaking our fists, telling you we can do whatever we want to do. And in the midst of that, on a cross, being mocked by humanity, you said, Father, forgive them because they don't know what they're doing. Our messes, Father, do not discourage or dissuade you from redeeming us. And Father, we pray and ask in those moments, those hinge moments when we can see things going one way or the other, that those words were, you told us, you are the light of the world, and whoever follows you will not walk in darkness. Would you bring through your Spirit those words to our minds when we're in those hinge moments of making a decision to honor and walk through with you, or to dishonor and make the mess worse. Thank you, Lord, for your grace and your mercy that's new every morning. It's ready for every mess. We thank you that the last thing that you said to us, you will never leave us in the midst of our growth and our midst of our immaturity as we're walking and growing in relationship with you. You will not leave us behind. I pray, God, I ask that your Spirit would just affirm that into our hearts as we look at our life and think, how could anything good come from this moment or from these days or from this season? Lord, for those that are carrying a heavy burden of mess, would you even right now, Lord, just remove that burden. Say, you'll take it as they get to the end of their rope and just cast it onto you. Whatever that looks like, Lord, I pray that right now you would just meet us in the midst of whatever mess is going on. Meet us with your grace and mercy. In Jesus' name,